Welcome to the Calder Farmstead, your place for news, analysis, and shenanigans from the American Hockey League.
Hello from Gobbler's Knob in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania.
And the home of the last AHL All-Star Game, Ontario, California.
Welcome to the Calder Farmstead Podcast, number 127 for Friday, February 3rd, 2023. If you were hoping for a podcast featuring farm animals that predict the weather, we are not going to be much help. This is an American Hockey League podcast. My name is Sean O'Brien from StatsTrack and the AHL's only league-wide analytics guy.
And I'm Sarah Avampato from Full Press Hockey and SB Nation's Canes Country.
As always, we thank you for tuning in with us. And if you're new to hearing Sarah and I talk about hockey, we're going to talk about some of the news as well as dive into some of the goings-on of eight teams around the AHL. We both watch a lot of AHL games. We're going to talk about what we see when we watch the film, as well as use some advanced stats to help us break it down. If that's new to you, you might want to head over to our YouTube feed or podcast feed, wherever you're listening to us from, and check out episode zero. It's a short primer on some of the stats we're going to be talking about, as well as how we view what's important on the ice. So if you're new to some of the more advanced hockey stats terms like PDO or the point shares model, or newer hockey terms like controlled zone entries or Royal Road, go check that out so you better be able to pick up what we're putting down. I promise it's not that nerdy or technical. It's only 20 minutes, and let's be honest, you wasted 20 minutes thinking that Phil would predict an early spring. It's always more winter, every time. Man always sees his shadow. You'll never get that time back. So next time, why not spend a little more time with us talking hockey? Sarah, are you a big Groundhog's Day person?
I mean, being originally from Pennsylvania, like you think that I would be, but yeah, the stupid little creature always just sees a shadow. Like, he just brings me more depression. So, like, what? Great. Thanks, rodent.
I think it's funny, like, how contained it is. Like,
yeah,
I spent a lot of time in central PA, and it's like, oh yeah, it's Groundhog's Day. Woohoo.
Yeah. It's literally just Punxsutawney.
It's literally just Punxsutawney. Like, there's, I think, one or two other sites kind of scattered randomly throughout the country that try and do the same thing. But like none of them are as big.
No.
And I mean, let's be honest, this is Bill Murray's fault. Like, yes, none of this happens or none of the like this gets to this level without Groundhog's Day, which is a classic movie.
Yeah.
I also just think it's funny that like Bill Murray is the main character in two separate movies that popularized like rodents, one being Groundhog's Day and the other Caddyshack.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that is a strangely specific, you know, Bill Murray fact.
Yes,
but
that's a good trivia question for someday.
Yeah, for me, it's silly, but like a lot of our holidays are silly.
Right.
So like, I don't think I there is at least probably some percentage of the population that thinks Phil actually can predict the weather just because that is the education level of our, our, you know, great society. Right. But like, yeah. In the same sense, it's hopefully like 4% at most. Kind of like, but I mean, a lot of other holidays that we celebrate are stupid. Valentine's Day is silly.
Incredibly stupid.
Very stupid. But like, nobody seems to mind that everyone just kind of enjoys it. So like, if people enjoy Groundhog's Day, whatever.
Right.
All right. 3 minutes in, we've already gone off the rails.
Yes,
all right.
That's fine.
Let's circle back here. This is upcoming All-Star weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Sunday Monday event, which is
so weird.
A choice. Yeah, I don't know why. Like in Canada, are weekends Sunday Monday? Or But there have been some all-star roster changes here. Let's run through them really quickly. In the Atlantic, Xavier Ouellette is now Alex Nylander. Cam York is Ruslan Ishkakov. Vinny Leteri is Jack Eichon. And Will Cooley is Zach Jones. In the North, just two changes. Justin Barron becomes Alex Belzile, and Brandon Biro becomes Lukas Raucik. In the Central, Tommy Novak becomes Luke Evangelista. And in the Pacific, Brad Hunt becomes Jean-Luc Foudy. Daniil Marimano becomes Braden Paschal. And Andrew Podorowski becomes Max McCormack. Now, of all of these, Belzile's having a surprisingly good season. Like, I remember when I first saw that, I was like, really? Mm-hmm. And then I looked, I did not realize that Alex Belzile was very low-key having a decent year. Yeah. So, good for him. The other one that was really surprising to me, Brandon Paschal for Daniil, was Cormier unavailable?
Like, right, like, was he the only one who wanted to go?
Yeah.
The other, no, like, offense, but
some, actually for me, some offense. Like, you're honestly, you're not even a part of the Silver Knights blue line that I like. Like, I actively do not like Braden Paschal as a player. Yeah. As a dude, yeah. I'm sure he's
a dude.
Probably okay. Like 50-50. He could be terrible. Hockey. I don't know. Yeah. But like the other thing too that I noticed is when we first had the all-star rosters come out, the Atlantic was the only one with three defensemen. Every other division had 4D. And now every division is 3D. And I don't understand why that happened, especially because, like, I'm assuming this is a 3-on-3 tournament mm-hmm. format, like what the NHL does. So they have seven forwards and three defensemen and two goalies. Like, that doesn't really make a lot of sense for making three lines.
No,
but okay. Whatever, AHL All-Star Game.
Right, they tried.
They made some choices here. Like the rosters don't really fit perfectly to a comprehensive, like, rolling out three lines. It's on a Monday is the day of the game, which I don't even know why. Like, what was the? I would love to ask the AHL brass how that part came to be, because that's the most confusing.
Yeah, and I feel like it's been like that before. Like, I feel like there's this always not when you think it's going to be.
So is there, like, I don't know, the only other reason I can think of is because it's also NHL All-Star Weekend. Mm-hmm. So, like, did they not want to overlap the NHL game? Because, like, if you have the choice between watching the AHL skills competition and the NHL skills competition,
right?
No offense, you know what you're watching.
Right.
So by kind of flipping that, are they, like, trying to take advantage of that? I don't know. Maybe. Like, maybe that's the thought process. I feel like you could have just put them on at different times.
Yeah.
Or had, like, the AHL All-Star Skills Competition be on the NHL Network and lead into the NHL.
Right.
Like, that seems like that.
I think it's also, like, I mean, there's still AHL games being played on Saturday. So, like, I also wonder if making it be, like, Sunday, Monday is just them being, like, well, we're trying to maximize, like, I know that, you know, I'm out here on the West Coast right now. Like, the guys that are out here have to literally, like, they play their game on Saturday. They get on a plane after the game and leave to go to Laval. Like,
that's not a good, like, especially, too, like, what if one of those dudes gets hurt, you know?
Yeah.
There's a very non-zero chance one of these dudes, because they're all playing big minutes and, you know, key situations for their teams, except for Braden Paschal, but that's a different story. But, like, so, you know, the chance that a stray puck hits, and I'm literally just going to look at the roster and pick one at random, Max Lajoie, you know, and, you know, bust him up a little bit.
Yeah.
Can't go to the All-Star game. Then what do you do? Like, you don't have.
I hope all of the, like, Laval Rocket got, like, have just stayed in town, and then they just stuff a Laval guy into a Max Lajoie jersey and see if anyone notices.
That's the other thing. Yeah, it's like, what, this does not feel very well thought out in the scheduling aspect of it. Anyway, like, they really should have cut games off. Like, try to jam as many of them either in Monday, Tuesday, or just be like, all right, look, we're going to push those games to dates later on in the season. Right. Like, you have an All-Star weekend every year, you have a season. So, like, what are we doing here? This is, I don't know. This is
making it hard.
It's not looking good so far. Any other thoughts on the All-Star weekend? We're going to touch back on it later in Start Benship. So there will be more All-Star conversation here. But Sarah, anything else to add, or are you ready to move on to our team dives?
I mean, I would just like to congratulate us on getting some of our picks for our rosters now at the All-Star game. Because I know, you know, Nylander was one that I think we both had on our rosters. And, you know, I'd like to think you can attribute some of that to us.
I would like to think so, too. I also didn't realize, too, when I was looking at this, because I saw Jean-Luc Foudy, and I was like, really? Jean-Luc Foudy? Because I remember that he had not had, like, he had struggled in previous seasons in Colorado. Put off, like, no, Jean-Luc Foudy is done. So there were a couple, you know, as much as we try and cover everyone in the entire league, there are still surprises out there. It's like, oh, he's actually doing kind of well.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big league. There's a lot of dudes.
Yeah, so many.
All right, let's get to it. As always, we are taking 8 teams, 2 from each division, because we aren't at the last episode of this go through yet where it's all Pacific, but we're going Atlantic to Pacific. And let's start in the sweetest place on earth, Hershey, Pennsylvania. Let's talk about the Hershey Bears. Sarah, the Hershey Bears and Providence Bruins have been kind of swapping places pretty much all season long in the Atlantic division. Fans of the Bears are used to success. So maybe this season doesn't feel any different from past strong performances. But do the Bears have what it takes to keep the top spot in the division as we get closer to the end of the regular season?
So Hershey's been one of the more interesting teams in the league for me to keep an eye on. When you look at them in terms of scoring, they're okay. Scoring, they've got 131 goals for, which is 15th in the league. So just smack in the middle. The goals against, however, fantastic. 107 goals against, which is the second fewest in the league, just behind Calgary and just ahead of Coachella Valley. So two other teams that we've talked about consistently on here as being contenders. For Hershey, goaltending is fine, but not spectacular. Zach Fucali in his last 5 games has allowed 15 goals, lost 2 of the last 5. Hunter Shepard in his last 5 games has allowed 13, also has lost 2 of 5. Neither of them are ranked particularly high by the model. Fucali, I think, is at replacement level. Shepard is at a backup level. So, you know, they're both just guys this year, according to the numbers. But the defensive environment that they're playing in is literally off the charts. Like, if you look at it, they're literally as far to the right that you can get in kind of a, I think you might have had to make the chart bigger to fit them on kind of way. Defensive environment, it's measuring shot and goal volume across strength, like all strengths of play. And right now, Hershey is allowing the fewest shots against per game. They're averaging 25.12. That is not even close to what we're seeing from other teams. They also have one of the best even strength goal differentials in the league. 1.52 against versus 2.19 per game. Their entire vibe is basically like, go on, girl, give them nothing. Like, if you're playing Hershey, good luck. Have fun. I don't know what's going to happen. The defense isn't kicking in much in terms of scoring, but they're keeping pucks out of the net, which is, last time I checked, the actual job of a defender. So, you know, good on them. Defensive point shares for Hershey defensemen, no one is below 0. The closest is Lucas Johansson, who only played 16 games, so it's not even a huge sample size to have a feeling about him. Gabriel Carlson, like, what is up with him? He's having a career year this year, already tied his out point in points, so he's at least contributing 12 points across 37 games and is generally pretty stingy defensively in his in-game action. And it's not just the defensemen who are getting it done. Pretty much any player regularly appearing as a forward is at least breaking even in terms of defensive point shares. There's not a lot of guys who are dipping below into that, like, oh, oops, kind of territory. So I looked at their recent game against Lehigh Valley, where Hershey won 7-3. And I feel like it was kind of a microcosm of the Hershey Bears this season. They didn't significantly outshoot the Phantoms. The shot total was 28-23, but they're able to create a lot of turnovers and create the kind of plays that get you goals. So I wanted in this game to look at both the goals that Hershey is scoring as well as the goals that they're giving up. Obviously, they scored a lot of goals in this game. So I just looked at the 3 goals against in the first period. Or the 3 goals that they scored in the first period. First goal, the Bears steal the puck in front of their own goalie, go the whole way down the ice. We're able to kind of catch Lehigh Valley by surprise on it. They weren't able to get enough players back to fend them off. Goal for Hershey. The second goal, again, play starts from back in their own end. Lehigh Valley basically gave them no challenge at all to enter that zone, get set up, and they had a pretty strong net front presence to be able to get that goal scored. Goal number three, first period, again, play starts all the way on their own end. They pick off a pass, get free on a 3-on-1 against the Phantoms, and I think you could guess how that ended, even if I didn't already tell you it was a goal. And that is kind of what you see from them the whole game. Some of that has to do with, you know, the Phantoms, who we're also going to check in on today, maybe not being so great at keeping other teams from getting into their zone. But, you know, Hershey managed to take, you know, take advantage of those errors that Lehigh Valley would make and would go for it. So then I looked at the goals against. Again, they scored three goals against. The first goal against was shorthanded for the Phantoms. And sure, you maybe would have liked to see Hershey press a little harder to keep that puck from going out of the zone. But it like the whole sequence is one of those where you're like, ah, nothing's going to happen. The guy's just going to carry the puck into the zone, put it sort of towards the goalie to waste some time. He puts it towards the goalie. It rolls up off of Fucali's arm and goes in the net. So great. Oops. The second goal against came on probably one of the strongest shifts that the Phantoms had in the game. They had extended zone time and the puck came in. It was a bouncing puck off of a rebound. Fine. Can't really complain about that. The third goal against, the initial shot made contact with a Hershey player and then got tipped in by Jackson Cates for the Phantoms. So two of those three goals, the weird rolls up your arm one and the weird oops bounced off a guy and bounced off another guy's stick, I don't know that I'd say that those are particularly repeatable. So that's one goal out of the three against that was like, all right, that's legit. That took some work to get that one scored. So they're not giving up goals that are particularly scary. In this case, overall, Hershey plays a pretty smart game. They're very economical. There's not a lot of wasted movement. There's not a lot of scrambling. Guys aren't out of position that often. You know, I'm not seeing bad line changes. There's communication on ice. It's a squad of guys who can capitalize on the other team's mistakes. When I watch Hershey Bears games, I don't have those moments of wondering why four guys are all standing in the same spot. Because four guys are never in the same spot. I mean, not never, anything can happen. But like, I haven't felt compelled to do the like screenshot of shame with Hershey Bears games to tweet it and be like, you'll never guess what happened next, because they just don't put themselves in those positions. They do really well at pushing the other team to the outside. The game against the Phantoms, the three goals that were scored were basically second chance opportunities or lucky weird bounces from in front of the net. There were very few kind of legit shots right up front against the goaltender. And this is another team where I'd love to see stats on block shots or missed shots. So it's not like the other team doesn't have possession. There's very clear sequences, even in this game, even against a lesser opponent like the Phantoms, where the Phantoms are in control for strong, long stretches of the game, but it's not showing on the box score in terms of shots or goals. So Hershey's doing something right in order to keep pucks out of their nets. They are, it feels weird to say, but like they're fun to watch. And I really love that I don't have to shame them on Twitter for all just piling up in one place and then getting scored on.
I will say too, one of the big differences I've noticed about the Bears this year under Nelson compared to previous years under Scott Allen, or previous year rather under Scott Allen, is the Scott Allen Bears, despite, you know, not having the talent level that Todd Nelson has because they were hurt, they were called up, that kind of thing, is that in general, the team seemed to be a little bit more balanced. They were not offense first, but they weren't defense first. They played a pretty balanced system. And while Todd Nelson hasn't made too many big schematic changes, one of the ones is much more of a focus on defense and focus on making sure that they are, you know, playing back in the neutral zone, keeping teams out of their end, getting more into shooting lanes. They're a little more structured on defense and a little more discipline in the defensive zone. It does seem like when breakdowns happen, they're getting caught in moments where defense are making pinches at the blue line or making plays in the neutral zone that they definitely should not be. There were a couple of times in, not the game against the Phantoms that you're talking about, but the one after that, where they basically traded blowouts. That second game against the Phantoms, there were a couple moments where you saw defenders making bad step ups at the blue line where they had no chance at that puck, had no business trying to make that pinch. And they got burned, you know, 2-on-1, 3-on-1 the other way, or were just not in good position. It seems like when those breakdowns happen, it's kind of in those transitional rush moments, or the possession that leads to the goal is caused by those kinds of mistakes. Whereas you see that kind of be like, it's an interesting style to play. I think it allows Hershey to kind of sit back in their own end. And then as soon as they get possession of the puck in their own end, it's get out of the zone, you know, fly down the ice. But that leads to them playing with a much lower pace than we see a lot of other teams do. If you look at the game pace chart on my Tableau page, like, Hershey is dead last in the league by a solid margin, whereas everyone else is pretty close to their neighbor, and it just kind of gradually goes down, and then it's like Hershey. Yeah. So that's interesting to me. It also makes me wonder how they're going to handle a team in the playoffs that has a lot of team speed. Mm-hmm. Like Providence, for example, or should they get there, someone like Toronto, or I have no idea how they would make it this far, but if Laval made it to the, you know, the North Division in the playoffs, like, I think Laval would give Hershey trouble in a 7-game series. Yeah. And that's different from the regular season for a lot of reasons. You dial more into your, you know, preparation for the team in the playoffs, whereas opposed to, you know, you play them once or twice over the course of a weekend, they're here and gone, and you forget about it.
Yeah.
So I think that's very much a big difference in the style of the Nelson Bears versus the Allen Bears. And I think that's helping contribute in kind of what you said. They're locking things down defensively, but it does make them a little bit of a slower team from a pace perspective, but they're still controlling the game.
Yeah. It's a fun time.
Absolutely. All right. Let's go to the other part of Pennsylvania and talk about the Lehigh Valley Phantoms. Sarah, tee us up here.
All right, so the Phantoms have special teams that are very different in terms of outcomes here. The PK is 31st in net penalty kill, although thankfully they only take about 4 penalties per game, which is about league average. The power play, on the other hand, is 8th in net power play percentage, but unfortunately for them, they are 31st in the AHL in drawing penalties. So, Sean, why does the Phantoms' power play work, but the PK does not?
So the Phantoms power play has actually a lot of similarities to other top power plays in the AHL, namely the Marlies, who we talked about in pretty good depth last week. But they also do some things that are unique to them. In terms of kind of doing the same thing others do, they use the double drop zone entry play, which if you've watched the Phantoms on the power play or pick a team in the AHL or NHL, you've seen this power play zone entry use. Basically, where one guy, you know, skates up to about the blue line with the puck, then turns and makes a drop pass to either one of two guys. That's why it's a double drop. There's two guys he could drop, make that drop pass to, and then they try to enter the zone. The Phantoms also use the 1-3-1 power play structure, which, you know, one guy at the points, one guy kind of in the high slot, two at the side walls, and then one at the net front. And they're looking for plays into the slot or into that bumper position in the high slots. They're looking for plays across Royal Road to the back door. They're setting up timers for your high-end shooters. One thing they've improved from previous seasons is utilizing Tyson Forrester on the power play. I remember when he first debuted with the Phantoms in the bubble and got power play time, and they tried using him in weird spots, like in the bumper or at the net front or on his strong side half wall. And I was really confused by this because it's like, just put him in the Ovi spot and let him do Ovi things. The man has an elite one-timer. Let him, you know, let Tyson Forrester light the forest on fire with that shot. But it took them a bit, but the Phantoms seemed to finally come around to that conclusion too, thankfully. And that's where he's been kind of on his offside half wall, just ripping pucks. And a lot of what we said about the Marlies last week in reviewing their power play is true here as well. But here's where the Phantom staff has kind of put their own wrinkles in what is a very common and very successful overall power play structure. First, they is in the zone entries. They use the double drop, you know, as we talked about, but they also mix in other entry plays. I've seen them work the center swing. I've seen them make stretch passes from behind their net straight to the far blue line and basically eschew any kind of actual zone entry play. Not a lot of teams you'll see do that. Basically, it's when the puck gets dumped back into their own zone and cleared, they kind of have a set play that they run more or less. But you see a lot of freedom for their players to improvise. And we talked about that last week too with the Marlies and how their players have freedom on zone entries to not just run the play as it's drawn up, but to improvise when they see something they can exploit. The Phantoms do that as well, but I think to a much higher degree. I see a lot of times where they have guys like Forrester or like Sell clearly going off script and attacking on the rush when the opportunity is there. Which brings me to the next point that kind of separates the Phantoms from the power play, on the power play from other teams. And that's that most teams, when they try and enter the zone, are trying to do just that. Just gain the zone, set up the power play structure, and, you know, run the offense. The Phantoms aren't that conservative. They, if they see an opportunity to make a rush chance, to create a 2-on-1 or an odd man rush, which isn't common on the power play, but they will do it. It's not just get gain the zone and then try and set up. It's gain the zone, and if you have a shot to score, do it. Go for it. And that's not what a lot of teams do. You don't see teams try and make basically small area 2-on-1s from the blue line. They're pulling up the wall, putting it back to the point to try and set things up. And the Phantoms do that too, but they also are willing to go for that quick strike, which can be risky, but they've had a lot of success making that work. In zone, the same thing is true about players' freedom to kind of go off script and make something happen. Last Friday's game against Hershey, Ollie Lixell basically took a lap around the offensive zone with the puck and then found Cal O'Reilly, younger brother of Ryan O'Reilly, on the back door for a tap-in. That is 100% not a scripted play where you have a player just skate basically from one corner all the way around and then make a cross-crease pass. Like, that's Ollie Lixell improvising and making something happen. And not a lot of coaches let their players do stuff like that, mainly because, A, most players can't do it successfully often enough, and B, most coaches are very risk-averse, so letting someone kind of go off the script that you've set in their mind opens them up to unnecessary risk. So this level of trust between the staff and the players isn't common, but they're being rewarded for it in these spots. On the flip side, on the penalty kill, if you missed our PK breakdown of San Diego from, I think that was last week, right, Sarah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Time is a flat circle.
Yeah, it's fake.
I told you that was a month ago, and I don't believe it.
Yeah.
San Diego last week, we talked about the only real thing that the Gulls do well on the ice, and that's kill penalties. It's probably a helpful primer here if you didn't catch that. As a Phantoms fan, I don't blame you. You know, why would you want to listen to the Gulls power play talk? But that's probably going to be a helpful primer here because the Gulls and the Phantoms do the exact same thing in terms of structure. For forechecking, they use a 1-3 forecheck in Lehigh Valley and San Diego. They play the check press in zone as their structure. We dive deeper into exactly what that means in our segment last week about the goals, which is why I'm encouraging people to go back and check that out. In short, the 1-3 forecheck is one forward pressing the puck carrier, trying to force play towards the boards. You'll see three guys kind of lined up in the neutral zone, and they're trying to create basically a choke point for the puck carrier at the blue line where that first forward is pressing them from behind and that defense is pressing them at the line. So they either have to turn the puck over or dump it in. Inside the zone, the check press, also sometimes called the wedge plus one, has two defensemen and one forward form like a small triangle in the slot to outnumber the offense in that key area, while the other forward basically acts as a puck chasing rover. That rover and the forward at the top of the triangle kind of interchange. They can cover more ground effectively. But on the PK, effective forechecking is one of the most important things you can do to kill penalties. The easiest way not to give up power play goals is to first not take penalties. The second easiest way to not let the other team score on the power play is to not let them gain the offensive zone. And that sounds very obvious, but that doesn't make it less true. Now, on the PK, you're obviously down a man, so keeping teams out of the zone 100% of the time just isn't realistic. You're always going to fail at some point, but it's about eating the clock, wasting the offense's time, and keeping them those number of times they do gain the zone down to a minimum. And the Phantoms are flat out not doing that forechecking on the PK at all. Their first forechecker is rarely getting any meaningful pressure. He's not forcing play very well to one side or the other. And the rest of the penalty killers rarely hold the blue line, some of which is due to the lack of effective pressure by that first guy. And teams gain the zone easily against the Phantoms penalty kill, which hurts them a lot. Because once an offense gains the zone and sets up, you know, their power play structure, preventing scoring chances is hard. That's hard work. So if you aren't doing some of that work up front, forechecking and, you know, cutting the other team's percentages down and the time that they can spend in the zone to create chances down, it gets a lot harder. And that's what we're seeing from the Phantoms. And once in the zone, the Phantoms use the same defensive structure that nearly every professional hockey team uses on the PK, except for one, which we're going to talk about later, but they use the check press. But their flavor of check press is very passive, and they don't execute it well. Unlike San Diego, where we talked about their discipline and their understanding and moving as a unit, the Phantoms don't. The defenseman and the forward that they have making that triangle in the slots, lose track of where players are behind them all the time. They don't scan over their shoulder well. They frequently lack details in what passing lane their stick is supposed to be in. They're late getting into shooting lanes, especially defensemen for shots from the half wall. Like, they are slow to respond there, and it absolutely kills them. One aspect of the Phantoms' PK, though, that does work pretty well is them generating shorthanded scoring chances. They're tied for 12th in shorthanded goals in the AHL. And you can see that when they do get a turnover or recover a rebound and gain clear possession of the puck in their own zone, they're looking like their other players are dashing out of the zone. They are looking to create scoring chances. They spring Max Willman all the time in this exact fashion, especially recently. I think in the last three games they played, he's had at least one good shorthanded rush chance in all three of them. The goal that you talked about that I think Ryan or that Cal O'Reilly, brother of Ryan O'Reilly, scored, that was like this fluke backhand one. I'm pretty sure he was meant that as a centering pass to Max Willman on that rush exchange.
Yeah.
So that does seem to be working for them. And that is an aspect that I think they should try and stick to. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of generating offense shorthanded here in a little bit. The rest of it, though, structurally, it's fine, but they're not executing it. And that's the problem. You can't, execution is greater than scheme every day of the week. If you aren't executing, it doesn't matter how good your scheme is. There's nothing wrong with what the Phantoms are structurally doing on the penalty kill. It's that they're not doing it well. All right. We could talk more about the Phantom special teams, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Let us head to our host for the All-Star Classic and talk about basically the exact same thing. Sarah, tee us up.
So speaking of teams with a killer power play and a poor penalty kill, let us talk about the All-Star hosting team, the Laval Rocket, who I think that every time we talk about them, we have talked about what is wrong with their penalty kill. The PK is 32nd in net penalty kill, but they do lead the AHL in shorthanded goals with 8th. So thankfully, they only take about 4 penalties per game, which is near league average. The power play, on the other hand, 5th in net power play percentage, and thankfully, they're also 4th in the AHL in drawing penalties. So, Sean, why does the Rockets' power play work, but the PK does not?
Deja vu, huh?
Yeah, feels, yeah.
So, the power play does a lot of things that we just talked about that the Phantoms do, but it doesn't have a lot of its own flavor. Like we talked about the Phantoms, you know, letting their players have a lot of freedom to kind of go off script and make moves when they see fit. Whereas Laval doesn't really do that. Like sometime you'll see some individual efforts that are clearly, you know, off what was drawn up on the board. But for the most part, like Laval power play works really well because they stick to the principles of effective power plays. They primarily use the double drop zone entry play. They use the 1-3-1 structure and they use it well. They set up shots from the inside. They look for Royal Road passes for backdoor plays or one timers. Like that's great. That's what you should do. And that alone is going to lead you to success in the power play if you can execute. And the Rocket have. The only thing I've really seen from them on film that looks a bit kind of unique to them is that they set up a lot of these kind of one touch and deflected passes into high danger areas. So either across the crease, across Royal Road, or kind of into that bumper or net front spot for a one timer. Like we talk about the Oshie play every once in a while, which basically you'll see a guy on the sidewall kind of pull a defender up towards him. And then he'll throw it to the player at the goal line and he'll just one touch that pass to the bumper for a shot. We call it the Oshie play because TJ Oshie has scored like 80% of his power play goals look just like that. If you go on YouTube and search TJ Oshie power play goal, you'll see like 8 replays of exactly the same thing. And it's the play I just described. And like Laval uses that, but they also kind of mix in a lot of these like one touch or like almost intentional deflection passes, like from the point to like that slot area or to across the crease. And that's a little unique, but like, that's really it. Their power play is strong and it's effective because it follows the basic principles of how to run a modern power play and doesn't put a lot of its own spice on it, which is fine, but doesn't make for a very fun breakdown. The penalty kill, on the other hand. So the Rockets PK has a lot of problems, but as you mentioned, they lead the league in shorthanded goals. But here's the plot twist. Those are related. Laval's in-zone defense isn't the check press, like at nearly every team plays. They use the very outdated diamond PK structure, which has merit in spots. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But what that means from a visual perspective, and we have a visual aid here to kind of help people, because, you know, if you've never seen a diamond before, you might not know what this looks like. But here is a screen cap basically from their game against Toronto, I want to say 2 weeks ago, roughly. But as you can see, it's one net front defenseman, one defenseman and one forward kind of guarding the faceoff dots there. One forward pressuring the point makes a diamond. It looks like that. It's really not that complicated. But to make matters worse, Laval is very passive in this structure, which I have always said is a bad thing. You can't be passive and just give time and space to the best offensive players on the other side. That's bad to begin with. That will always, no matter what structure you use, be a negative thing in my mind, and the results back that up. The diamond is outdated because of the 1-3-1 power play and the setup that basically every team in the league uses, which is what Toronto runs right here. And you can see, Sarah, does anything stand out to you just looking at this image of why this is not a good idea?
Well, there's that one little man back there by the goal who no one even is like paying attention to. I don't like that if I'm a penalty killer. Why is he back there?
The other thing, too, is anyone really covering the bumper?
Yeah, no.
Is anyone really capable of covering the bumper in this structure, given how it's set up?
No.
So if you get that puck to the bumper, you basically have a small area 2-on-1 with the other guy in the front of the net. And that's the highest value real estate that there is. That seems kind of bad, doesn't it?
Don't do that. Don't do this. Don't do that.
Yeah. So the Diamond's focus is to pressure and force turnovers on the outside, something Laval doesn't do a great job of because they're kind of passive. They don't force turnovers. They kind of just happen to them. However, when you do force a turnover on the outside in the Diamond, generating a rush chance the other way is easy, as you already have players who are higher in the zone, who are ready to sprint, in prime position. And because Laval has a lot of speedy players like Anthony Richard, springing them for shorthanded scoring chances off the rush is something you can maximize with the diamond formation. And that's why I said it's outdated, but it still has some value. And that's if you have to kill a penalty, you know, in the later stages of the third period where you're down by a goal and it's more important for you to try and generate offense necessarily, play the diamond. That's a much better use of it when the chips are down and you need to make some offense here. However, as a run of the mill, you know, use, it's not getting you places. So those eight shorthanded goals are directly related to their end zone diamond structure. Because as you can see, like even in this picture, that top guy at the top of the diamond blocks a shot. He has a 2-on-1 with him and one of the other side guys pretty easily, right? Like they're going to win the race to that puck. But so like they're creating more shorthanded goals, but they're also creating more power play goals against. Mm-hmm. As we talked about, you know, your one forward pressures the point, two pressure the side walls, one in front of the net. So any puck movement from the half wall or from the point to the bumper creates that, you know, inner slot 2-on-1. That's super bad. You're also putting a premium on covering the perimeter and pressuring the perimeter and not covering the slot. Like that's the opposite of how valuable real estate in the offensive zone works and how you want to defend it. So if these players on the half wall, you know, on the offensive side also crash the net, that leaves them wide open because there's the diamond also opens up diagonal passing lanes. So like if you see if I can use the mouse over here, like this point guy here, if he steps over and this guy crashes the net, wide open lane. Mm-hmm. That's why like geometrically the diamond doesn't make sense. The other thing, too, with the diamond is that every single time the puck moves, which is a lot on the power play, three of your four penalty killers have to move and restructure completely to adjust to new passing lanes, new shooting lanes, all of that. And while that's true of most penalty kill schemes, it's much more exaggerated in the diamond because of how open the middle is and how responsible one player is for that area. In short, basically, the Rockets PK is bad because they run a scheme that maximizes offense and minimizes protecting the slot. And until that scheme changes, the Rocket are going to continue to score shorthanded goals, which is fun, but they're going to give up way more power play goals. And it's a lot better off for you to be, 82%, 83% penalty kill and only score maybe three or four shorthanded goals than to score 10 shorthanded goals, mm-hmm. but to give up, 74% on the penalty mm-hmm. kill.
Yeah.
Laval. So that is what's going on with Laval's special teams here. Sarah, any quick thoughts here or do you want to move on?
Maybe they can all like trade ideas when they meet people at the All-Star game. Like, can someone tell them at the All-Star game, like, hey, what you're doing isn't working.
That's the other thing too, is like, this is a scheme that teams abandoned like a long time
right. ago.
And like, it comes back in vogue once in a while as everything does, but like, then teams quickly adjust as to why this doesn't work mm-hmm. anymore. They're like, oh yeah, that's why we don't do this. Now, again, surprise. There is a time and a place for it, but it's a very narrow one in which it right. makes sense to generate exactly offense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we will say adieu to the Laval Rockets and say bienvenue. Wait, no, that's welcome. What's hello in French? Bonjour.
There you go.
Wow. Oh, Cece, maybe edit that. to the Belleville Senators. And Sarah, the Belleville Senators have had some moments early in the season where things look positive for them. But lately, it's been a slow kind of downward slide down the standings. Is there anything going on that might give Belleville fans hope? Or is this downward trajectory going to be the story of the season for them?
All right. So when we've talked about Belleville before, we've basically been like, what is going wrong with this team? And the answer continues to be everything. That still remains true today. However, here's a surprise news flash that has happened literally while we have been recording tonight. The Senators have fired their coach, Troy Mann. Yes, that literally happened like 15 minutes ago as we've been recording.
Oh, wow. So
the Ottawa Senators announced today that they've made changes to the coaching staff of their AHL affiliate, the Belleville Senators. Following Thursday's game, Troy Mann was relieved of his duties as the team's head coach. Assistant coach David Bell will take over as Belleville's interim head coach for the remainder of the season. Troy Mann has been with Belleville since the 2018-19 season as their head coach. This is a weird time span in which to say like, oh, these guys didn't make the playoffs because there were so many years where playoffs, like hockey was fake for a couple years because of COVID. They lost in the qualifying round last year. The first year he was the coach, they didn't make the playoffs. And then the last other two years were the weird COVID years. But so like what you're going to hear me talk about Belleville may be like not relevant depending on what their new interim coach does or does not do with them. I guess if there's anything going on that might give Belleville fans hope, you have a new coach. I don't know. Before I jump into like the rest of my thoughts, like what are your thoughts on this? Like, I feel like we haven't actually been able to process it, but I knew I couldn't talk about Belleville.
Yo, yeah.
Knowing this.
I'm glad it happened while we were recording and not like tomorrow morning.
Right. Right.
I've kind of thought like, and I think I've said this before on the podcast here and there, that like Troy Mann had to be feeling some heat on his seat. I still think he's a decent coach, but like to be completely fair to Troy Mann, Belleville's roster has not been, mm-hmm. Cup overflowing with top end talent for the AHL. He's had goaltending problems. He's had depth problems on the blue line where like he usually has one or two guys that are good. And then they kind of get backfilled with like borderline ECHL caliber dudes or like very defensive minded physical defensemen, which you need a couple of, but you also need guys who can move the puck and contribute. Mm-hmm. And they don't like, they have nobody who really jumps off the page that could do that outside of like when they had Michael Delzato or what's the one defenseman there? Eric Brandstrom.
Yeah.
But that was it. It would be like they have one, standout puck moving defenseman and then just a bunch of kind of dudes.
Yeah.
And not to mention on top of that, like they've had a goalie circus going on there. And that's really hard to build consistency when it's like, especially this year, it's like, is it Kevin Mandelis? Is it Mads Søgaard? Is it Antoine Bebo? All who play very different styles and who are average-ish. Like, none of them are, you know, standout goaltenders. It's not like they had Troy Grosnick or Max Lagasse or Tokarski, like, back there. Or, you know, when he was still a regular AHLer, Nedeljkovic. Like, they've always kind of had a goaltending by dude committee. Like, so I feel for Troy Mann a little bit, and, you know, having to basically play down to the talent level of your team. But at the same point too, like, they have definitely underachieved in moments. And like, I think Troy Mann will be fine. I'm not worried about him. Someone else will hire him somewhere. Like, he's had enough success on his resume that he'll be okay. I do think it's funny that you said they promoted us as interim, their interim coach is named Bell. Bell is Belleville coach. Like, that's, I don't know why that just amuses me, but
it is, it's very funny.
Let me pull, I'm not familiar with him. Let's, Sarah, say some things while I stall while I pick up, like, what his resume looks
right, what
like.
He does. Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing about this is, like, you know, so they fired him. We're recording Thursday night. They were fired him after the game that they played on Thursday night. Belleville won that game. Belleville won 5-3 over Rochester tonight. And they won, like, Belleville had 19 shots on goal. And they still won that game. So again, if we're talking about this division having just absolute hot garbage goaltending, here's another one. But yeah, so they win this game in fairly convincing fashion against a team that is above them in the standings. And the guy still gets the axe. Like, that's like Walking Dead kind of scenario. Like, they had to have known going into this game, like, that was going to be the outcome.
Yeah, if you're firing him after that game, you already made the decision, which I think is fine.
Yeah. But,
all right. So, especially too, like, right before the All-Star break, you get a little bit of a breather to kind of reset.
Yeah.
So, David Bell, 4 years as an assistant coach for the Belleville Senators, two before that as an assistant coach for the Ontario Reign, was the head coach for the Niagara Ice Dogs for a season, a bunch of more years in Niagara and in the OHL as an assistant coach. Not a lot of head coaching experience on here on his resume, but enough assistant coaching experience where it's, I feel like giving him a shot at the head coaching job is not, I wouldn't say terrible. Like, I think that's fine if they decide that they want to give it to him. Who was the other assistant that they passed over? Ben Sexton. I think I remember that name. No, never mind. Ben Sexton has only ever been an assistant coach for the Belleville Senators after playing for the Belleville Senators.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Who would have guessed?
Shocking.
Yeah. So it's, if you had to promote one of them, David Bell was definitely the better choice over Sexton, especially because I don't think Bell played at a high level. Oh, no, he played a little bit in the AHL, but not a whole ton. Mm. So, and never for Belleville. So that at least makes it feel better.
a little less nepotism-y.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, I definitely think that he's worthy of a fair shot at the permanent job. Like, his resume is at least good enough to go from interim to head. Not saying that he will. But he definitely is motivated knowing that, you know, he could be a fit there. But that's surprising to kind of do mid-season. Like, I don't expect, maybe he'll get a little coaching bump. Just, you know, guys wanting to impress the new guy.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens there. I definitely felt over the last couple seasons that Troy Mann was starting to dance on the line of, like, all right, you're pushing some guys into the NHL, which is good, but you're not winning here. And even though we're not giving you the most firepower we could, we still need you to make a better go of it. Which, is that necessarily fair to him? No, probably not. But, like, I feel like the time for a change is appropriate here. Like, this is, I still think Mann's a decent coach, but I can see why Belleville chose to move on here. They're still selling Ottawa's still selling too. So I could see them not making a decision until after it's official that Deadpool owns the franchise. So The other thing too is like, I don't think there's too many good names out there available right now for a permanent hire. So it looks like David Bell, unless he really screws it up, which seems unlikely, should be at least in the mix at the end of the season for this head coaching gig. Who knows? Teams are also at the AHL, which would be like, weird. Oh, you did good enough. Here's the head coaching job. So
yeah, hang out here for a little while. So weird.
All right. Let's talk about Belleville before Troy got fired.
Yeah. So other fun fact, obviously, because time is a thing. All the numbers that you're going to hear were put together before they played this game against Rochester. And I am not good enough at math to adjust all those numbers on the fly. So we're just going to pretend that game didn't happen because I can't add or subtract in my head. So, you know, go with it. So in the month of January, they have won 7-11 games. They started the year strong. They had 3 straight wins, or they've lost 7 of 11 games. See, I can't even do my own math here. Great. In the month of January, 7 of 11 games, they lost them. They started the year strong with 3 straight wins. And while I was told there would be no math, because clearly I just failed at it, that means they've won just 1 game since January 7th. That was a 2-1 overtime win over Laval. Again, aside from this game that just happened, that doesn't count. They lost 2 straight to Springfield, a team that's been bouncing around near the bottom of the standings in their division. In fairness to the Senators, because I can't be totally mean to them, the schedule has been kind of brutal. Sure, there were games against Laval, Springfield, teams that aren't that great. They played Rochester, Syracuse, Manitoba twice, Cleveland, Toronto twice, Hershey, basically the entire rest of the North Division with a couple other bonus teams. So they've had a hard path because they basically been playing against their competition. The last 5 games they played, outscored 20-9. That's bad. They were outshot 175-143, average about 35 shots against, 28.6-ish for. The special teams have been failing them. The power play was 3-for-25 over the last 5 games for 12%. The current net power play overall is 15.7, so a little lower than their season average. The PK was 20-for-29, so 70% success there, which is also a little lower than their current rank. Net PK is at 79%.
Yeah, but so, why did Troy Mann get fired, Sarah?
Shocking. Who knows? Magic. So would you like to guess in this last game against Springfield that they played, how many power play goals, you know, the Senators allowed? So how many times did their PK just totally blow it in this game against Springfield?
I'm going to go with 2.
No, that's incredibly wrong. They allowed 4 on 10 chances.
Jesus.
Yes. And these were all, the penalties were stupid penalties. There was an extended shift where they couldn't get the puck out of their zone. They tripped a Falcons player behind the net. There's a holding call where they're jostling with a Springfield player right in front of the net and right in front of a ref who immediately does this. There was a slash behind the play. Again, so they had 4 power play goals, or 4 scored against them. There were 6 goals total in this game. The 5th goal was scored seconds after the end of a penalty. So essentially 5 of the 6 Springfield goals were scored while the Senators were shorthanded. Now for my next trick, how many of those 10 penalties were taken by just one player?
3.
Close, but no. Dylan Hetherington took 5 penalties.
Holy Christ.
He took a holding call, a slashing call, a tripping call, a delay of game call, and a charging call. On 3
a
of those
charging
5,
call.
A charging call.
In the year of our Lord, 2023.
Yes.
I don't know how you put him back on the ice. Jesus. All
well,
right.
Fortunately, wow. The charging call came with like 4 minutes left in the game. Yeah. It was a time. It was a time for him. 3 of those 5 penalties Springfield scored on. So he didn't have the greatest night of his life game.
Jesus, now, yeah. I mean, if you're Troy Mann, how do you put him back on the ice after penalty number 4?
Right.
Yeah, I can see now how Troy Mann's getting fired here. Jeez.
Overall, Belleville's one of the most penalized teams in the league. They've been shorthanded 191 times. That is third behind the Barracuda and the Gulls. Neither of those teams are also lighting it up in terms of like being great. The penalties that they're taking are not the kind that you'd call a good penalty. They're not hauling someone down on a last-ditch effort to save a goal. It's not like a oops, high stick. They're largely like stick infractions, the delay of game. That chart, like literally you have 5 minutes left in the game, you're losing. Why are you charging someone? Like, why did you do that? These are careless, sloppy plays. They're the kinds that you see when a team is outmatched and struggling to keep up with their opponent that's just head and shoulders better than them. And again, this was just against Springfield. No disrespect to the Springfield Falcons, but I didn't even look at the Toronto games. So I can only imagine how those went. If you're going to take that many penalties, you need to learn to kill them off better. We've talked about the Gulls now a couple times with their PK. They take a ton of penalties, but they do a good job at killing it off. So like you would sure like to see them in the box less, but at the end of the day, you have some confidence that they're not going to get scored on. That's not happening with Belleville. Right now, they're projected to end the season outside the playoffs picture. And having watched them, I can't say that I disagree. I know the standings are tight. They're in last place in the division, but they're just one point behind Cleveland, six back of Laval. And usually we'd say and have said on this show, like, there's a ton of room for movement here. Anything's possible. You know, 2 weeks from now, you can tell me they're in a playoff spot and I'll believe it. But I, you know, coaching, even with this coaching change, like, I don't see. We also have to pay the attention to the NHL here because Ottawa, while slightly more respectable than in recent years, are still slipping further out of the playoff contention. Like it's not going to happen. They have a handful of interesting pending unrestricted free agents who could make good rentals. So Ottawa can ship people out. There's going to be roster spots to fill, and it might come down to some of Belleville's top players to do it. So any kind of momentum they might have with, you know, the coaching change bump or anything, very quickly is going to get dashed because Ottawa may just like cannibalize this team.
Yeah. I feel like if Troy Mann wouldn't have been fired tonight, we wouldn't have talked about that. My question for you now would have been like, do you feel like there's some heat under Troy Mann's seat? Because like hearing a lot of this, it very much feels like a, you know, a Chicago remake where he had it coming.
Yeah, because like it feels like the only thing, like sometimes you get into a position where it's like that's the only move you can make, like the roster is what the roster is.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, Troy Mann graduated a lot of important players from Belleville to Ottawa, but like, and I feel like in previous years his team has at least had sandpaper to them. They've at least gone down swinging. Like they weren't a good team, but they at least fought till the end. Whereas the last couple of weeks, as you describe here, you cannot describe that as fighting to the end. It very much sounds like a team that needs a new voice, that needs new guidance, even if it's not better guidance. It's just the same guidance. Sometimes, you know, you hear the same voice for too long, even if it's saying the same things as the new voice, it feels different. It's kind of, you know, like how your car feels like it drives better after you wash it, or, you know, you seem like you get to your destination faster when you switch the voice on Google Maps or on Waze. Like it's the exact same thing that you're doing,
right?
But it just feels different. So like, yeah, you firing Troy Mann here makes a lot more sense having an Alfred that, but still, we check in with teams all the time, but like it's Belleville. I don't feel like I had a good grasp on how badly it's been going. So yeah, this move makes a lot more sense given the big context you just hit me with there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything more you would like to add to Belleville before we move on?
Thank you to the Senators for firing your coach like 8 minutes into when we started recording. I really appreciate your timing.
Thank you, Sarah, for being on that. Because, like, I mean, I wouldn't have caught that mid-show recording. I'm busy grandstanding over here myself about diamonds.
I mean, that's important. I'm, you know, looking at Twitter.
Thank you. So I think that's a good place to leave it. We're going to take a break here. And after the break, we will get to Rockford, Manitoba, Calgary, and Abbotsford. If you're just here for an Eastern Conference team and this is your jumping off point, Thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you are listening to us from, so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media, where we have a good time. Links to our social media and more can be found on our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. We're going to run some ads, pay some bills. We will be right back. Stay tuned. And we are back from break, and we are headed over to the West Coast, the best coast. Let us start in the Central Division and talk once again. A pretty quick turnaround here, but that's what happens when you pull names out of a hat, about the Rockford Ice Hogs. After spending a good chunk here diving into their offensive zone scheme and praising it for its innovation, the Ice Hogs have scored three or more goals in a game just twice in January, because of course they did. Praise the offense and then it tanks. Sarah, is this bad luck, injuries and call-up concerns, a bit of both, or something deeper?
So the short answer is a bit of both. Players who have been called up on the Rockford Ice Hogs to Chicago since the start of January: Lucas Reichel, Brett Cini, Jackson Stauber, Philip Roos, Luke Phillip, and then Isaac Phillips was called up mid-December and didn't come back until mid-January. Also, that is three players whose names include something sounding like Phillip. Just putting that out there. Reichel and Cini have definitely been two critical players for the Ice Hogs. We talk about them pretty much anytime we're looking at this team. In terms of skaters, all of the guys except for Roos essentially rank as like top line, first pairing sorts of guys. Stauber as a goaltender, his absence made the goaltending situation even more precarious. Arvid Soderblom has had some combination of injuries and also being up in the NHL. So they've spent a lot of time running with just ECHL goalies when Stauber's been up in the NHL. So like it's been a little bit of a mess. Taking a look at Lucas Reichel in particular, he was off the roster from January 3rd through the 13th when he was up in the NHL. In that time, Rockford played four games. They won one in regulation, one in overtime, and lost twice in overtime, scored a total of 8 goals throughout those games. And things haven't been easy for Reichel since returning. From January 14th to present, he's played in 8 games. He's had 4 assists and no goals. That is his longest stretch this season without a goal. And he's also not getting the puck much either. He's had just 9 total shots over those 8 games, 3 games where he's been kept off the board entirely in terms of shots. Compare that to the span of 10 games immediately before he had that call up. 3 goals, 9 assists, and 21 shots. Obviously not the performance that you want to see from the guy who's kind of your star player. Not really sure why. Like, it's not like his game has changed. It's not like his line mates have changed, which really just sort of feels like a bad span. You know, it's going to happen. It just has happened at a really bad time for him. They've also had injuries to deal with. Garrett Mitchell is done for the season. He had a shoulder injury early in the season, missed a month with that, and then came back and basically immediately re-injured the same shoulder and is now done for the season. Buddy Robinson broke his wrist, and he's going to be out for at least a month. He's, depth role player, but played a big role in terms of like net front presence. So they're going to miss that from him. Soderblom is back in net, but he missed time with a groin injury and hasn't really looked the same since he came back. And he's someone who I am used to seeing him like goalie teams all the time. And he has looked really underwhelming since coming back. The power play has been in a bit of a rough patch lately, which feels more like bad luck than anything else. They're 3-for-19 in their last 5 games. That's a 15.8%. There was a game that they played against Iowa, who is neither of our favorite team. They went 0-for-3 against Iowa. And Iowa did a great job at clogging up shooting lanes. But again, the Ice Hogs are generally a better team than the Iowa Wild, and you would expect them to be able to deal with that. The PK is also struggling too, 12-for-18, 66.7%. They allowed 3 power play goals on 3 attempts against Milwaukee. So that was a big goose egg in terms of power play or penalty kill success in that game. The power play, I think, is something that will get back to where we're used to seeing it. If you did miss the last episode we talked about the Ice Hogs, I would recommend going back and finding it. The game-specific information is going to be a little bit outdated, but the breakdown that Sean does talking about the Ice Hogs power play is and its structure and how it's fairly unique, I think is really worth a listen. So if you did miss that, like, go check it out. And I think it'll kind of explain why this is more of a temporary blip and instead of a like, oops, we all forgot what we're doing. The PDO for Rockford has cratered over the past couple of weeks. They've sort of hovered right around 100 for large parts of the season, sometimes a little bit up, sometimes a little down, but not seeing the same wild fluctuations that we see in other teams. Lately, it's just been like nosedive bad.
Let's pull that up here real quick.
Let's look at the pretty chart. Because it definitely made me kind of go, oh, huh, yeah, that.
Yeah. that is a drop.
Yes.
That is absolutely massive. I believe they are currently the lowest of any Central Division team. Because Manitoba there, Chicago there, Iowa, where's Milwaukee? Yeah. So they are the coldest running team in the Central Division right now, and probably one of the coldest teams in the AHL. Although, nope, San Diego still.
Well, wow, that has gotten worse since we last looked at it.
Yeah, but that's a story for another time.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, when you look at that, they have been fairly consistent in staying in that sort of middle blob, which makes me think that these past couple of weeks, they're going to bounce back from it. You know, overall, this is a team that's pretty high risk, high reward. When we see them at their best, they're dominating the score sheet. They're scoring on chances that maybe you think they shouldn't be scoring on. But when they're at their worst, they're getting pushed around by other teams. They can't necessarily deal with the physicality, especially missing guys like Mitchell and Buddy Robinson, who played more of that sort of game. They end up letting other teams dictate the terms of play. They lose puck battles, and then you lose the game. It doesn't look like they're doing anything different structurally than previously. So this really feels like the perfect storm of injuries, call-ups, and slumps that have just sort of nosedived this team. It feels like something they can weather. They're 2-6, 2-0 in their last 10, which is not great. They just ended a 7-game losing streak with a shootout win over Manitoba. So it's possible things are starting to swing up, but they do need to right that ship fast so that they're maybe a little more steady before the team gets blown up at the trade deadline.
All right. Yeah, Rockford, definitely that PDO chart definitely sums up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's never going to get the job done. No team with a 92 PDO is winning games. That's just
no. No.
All right. Let's move on here and talk about the Manitoba Moose. Sarah, the Moose started the season on a high note, taking advantage of a weaker than usual Central Division. That has not been the case lately, though, as they've lost 5 of the last 10 and have fallen down the standings. What does the picture look like for the Moose as we head into the All-Star break?
So speaking of teams that have been pretty up and down all season, may I introduce you to the Manitoba Moose? Right now, you could tell me they're literally anywhere in the standings in the Central, and I think that I'd believe you. They're currently fourth. They've got 48 points, so they're tied with Rockford with 3 games in hand. They're 10 points above Grand Rapids. So while at times the gap between making the playoffs and not had been a lot more narrow, that gap is starting to widen. It's safe to say that the Moose are going to finish in that 3-5 range. The model currently has them predicted to finish third behind Texas and Milwaukee. And, you know, talking about some goofy PDO charts, their rolling PDO chart has basically looked like a zipper zigzag thing all season, which is why I'm not surprised you could tell me they're first or eighth or whatever, and I'd be like, eh, sure. One thing that's been important for Manitoba is they haven't lost a huge amount of games from key players and no games lost from their goalies. So there have been call-ups. They lost Mikey Essamont at one point, first to the NHL and then to waivers. It hasn't really impacted them as much as some other teams in their own division. Now, we've talked about the Ville Heinola problem on this show. He's a player who I think everyone kind of agrees is a little too good for the AHL, but hasn't really been able to get an extended look in the NHL. He did get a 10-game stretch of games with Winnipeg through late December and mid-January, only had one assist during that time, and averaged 13 minutes and 16 seconds of ice time, which is, right, like the second lowest for all defensemen in Winnipeg. There was one game that he only played like 8 minutes. So sure, he's getting into games there, but how much opportunity did he really get to shine, to show what he can do to get into a rhythm and do something other than just like skate around on the third pairing? The good thing is that since he returned to the AHL, he has been doing what I would want to see from him. He has 4 points in three games, 12 shots in that span. The goal that he scored was a shorthanded goal. And if you bridge the gap from now to prior to his NHL call-up, he's got an 8-game point streak going, 2 goals and 9 assists in that time span. So, like, I'm sure he's disappointed to be back here, but it's not showing in his game, which I think is really important. We both pegged him, I think, as not ending the season with the Moose or the Jets, given earlier talk from his agent about maybe wanting a trade request. And if that's so, and if he's still looking to get a fresh start somewhere else, well, he's doing the best that he can for himself to still get moved. So it stinks for him to be back in the AHL, to have not really gotten much of a chance in the NHL, but he at least is making the best of his opportunity while he's back here. Looking at goaltending, I believe the phrase is perfectly cromulent. When you look at the chart that is showing, you know, defensive environment versus goals saved above average, you cannot possibly get any more perfectly in the middle of this chart than Arvid Holm and Oskari Salminen. Like, it is just completely average in every way. So they're doing fine, maybe stealing a game every so often, but not necessarily like tanking you. One of their bigger problems is even strength scoring. In terms of even strength goals, they're giving up way more than they're getting. 2.05 per game versus 2.38 against. So they're getting the work done on special teams. The net power play is second in the league with 23.6%, putting them just behind Toronto. The last five games could be better. They've been 3-for-13 in their last five games. So that's a little struggling and might show why they've slipped down the standings. The net penalty kill is 86.1%, which is eighth in the league. The PK has been great over the past five games. They've allowed just 2 goals in that time for an 89.5% success rate there. They've been outshot over the last five games, 166-140. They basically break even in terms of scoring, 15 goals for versus 14 goals against, but they've won 3 of 5. They've gotten points in a fourth. So like something is working. Is it like, are they having flashy, exciting, fun games? Not necessarily, but they're winning games. And in the Central Division, as long as they stay ahead of Grand Rapids, they're going to be fine.
Yeah. And the Moose have never been that kind of flashy, you know, high flying team. It's always been a every aspect by committee kind of approach. And that's not surprising to see that they've still managed to stick to that kind of philosophy. Yeah. But yeah, them getting outscored that badly at even strength is surprising. They are sharing space here with such luminaries as Belleville. They're not that far from Cleveland, Rochester, Grand Rapids. That's really not what you would think for a team that is, in general, doing pretty decently and expected to finish second or third in the division to be, you know, that reliant on the power play to get things going. But all right, I think that's a good place to leave it there. Let's head over to the Pacific Division. Once again, the Calgary Wranglers getting another kind of, you know, quick turnaround episode. So let's talk about them a little bit. Sarah, tee us up.
So the Wranglers are currently second in the AHL by points percentage. The model has the current Wranglers roster projected to win the AHL's regular season title with 99 points and has their worst case scenario as a 91-point team. They're currently on another hot streak, winning 6 of their last 7 games. So what has been the biggest secret to the Wrangler success?
Honestly, I still think it's the coaching staff that drives it. And that's not to dismiss the talent on the roster or what they've accomplished, but they run a very labor-intensive system in all three zones. And when the Wranglers are on, which is most nights, they aren't giving you anything for free. And that takes a full team buy-in to what your coaching staff is preaching. They're fourth in the AHL in game pace, and when you watch the film, it confirms that. This team is pressuring puck carriers all day, every day. If you're an opponent and you have the puck, you can safely bet there's a Wrangler on your ass, like a Brett Favre 2012 halftime commercial, which, let's be honest, that's the only good version of Brett Favre since 2012. Just ask the New York Jets or Mississippi's welfare funding. Regardless, this Wranglers team hustles its ass off by design and executes at such a high level all the time. And that's possible because of the talent they have on the roster, but also because the coaching staff has everyone on the same page and ready to run through walls for them. I call that high-quality coaching. That being said, the pressure that the Wranglers impose on other teams is just as impressive because it's not passive pressure where forecheckers are trying to kind of steer play into choking points like the blue line. It's in your face, you better know what you're doing and not bobble that puck kind of pressure. It's a system that requires the Wranglers to go out and skate hard and be physical every single shift, because if you don't, you spread yourself really thin playing that way. So it's a total team. Everyone goes out there and does their job and works hard every single game. And even when they have possession, the Wranglers play an offensive zone style that has a ton of dynamic pieces, a lot of movement. You don't see guys just kind of standing in one place waiting for good things to happen. They're moving around. They're getting open. They're creating passing lanes. They're shifting around. They mix in, you know, those two, three kind of offensive zone scheme looks that we see the IceHogs use. They don't feel fully adopt it, making them kind of the Batman to Rockford's Bane. But I think that works for them because it allows them to be more flexible with certain lines and certain player combinations where they don't have to kind of force square pegs into round holes. And I also think it makes them a bit harder to predict because then you have to prepare for more as a team that's defending them. But when they're clicking, like I said, you aren't getting free chances. Sarah, you are in Ontario. The game against the Rain from Sunday, how many chances do you think the Rain got in that game that were just given to them? Like basically just a sloppy mistake that Calgary made. They walked right in and got a good chance.
Yeah, that would assume that Calgary made mistakes in that game, and I think that they didn't.
Yeah, I don't know, having watched the film, if that number is zero, but it's a number that rounds down to zero. Like Ontario had scoring chances for sure in that game, but they had to work. They had to earn nearly all of them. And, oh yeah, when the defense does break down and gives up a rare scoring a chance, Teen Wolf, one of hockey's best goaltending prospects, is back there to make saves. If the Wranglers were to hit a bad stretch here that isn't the usual, you know, getting bad puck luck, everyone is called up or injured, I'd like to point out that their labor-intensive play on the ice is just that, labor-intensive. So back-to-backs or 3-4s, those later games are probably going to be rougher on the Wranglers than most other teams because they're going to be tired because they, like, their system of play is skate, 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 hit, skate more, hit some more. Like, it is one that is going to tire you out. And while Mitch Love has made changes from Cale McLean, I want to say was their previous coach. Mm. Yeah. That's, and I remember in the bubble when they were in the Canadian division and like that last month where they played something absurd, like 19 games in 30 days or whatever. And you could tell that that team just ran out of steam. Like, Mitch Love has changed the system a little bit, but not that much. And should they have to play a lot of those, like, hard kind of 3-4s or, you know, 4-6 kind of schedules, I could see them wearing down and starting to not show that same, you know, pressure ability, because it's hard to go out there and burn your legs every night, you know, 72 games in a row. But lucky for the Wranglers, their schedule the rest of the way is pretty smooth sailing in terms of back-to-backs, 3-3s, and such like that, that they have. It's pretty minimal the rest of the way based on me looking at the schedule a little intensely. Like, I didn't, you know, do any math or anything, which is, you know, unusual. But I did look at it, and it's they do not have a lot of, you know, heavy back-to-backs or I don't think they have any 3-3s, which good for them. But if they can keep this roster together and healthy, the Pacific Division title is basically just a two-horse race between them and Coachella Valley at this point. And I said at the beginning of the season, I actually talked with a fan who has a betting pool with friends where they pick the team that's going to win the Calder Cup in the beginning of the season. And he asked me who I would choose. And I said, I think he said one of the guys who's a big Cleveland homer took the Monsters, and then someone else took the Marlies, and then someone took Coachella Valley. I said, Calgary is a good choice here. Like, they struggled a little bit at the beginning of the season, but I'm like, I have faith that that team will right the ship. And man, I look smart right now, don't I? Like, they're a team that, as long as they can keep this team healthy and in the Wrangler side and not the Flame side, which, given Daryl Sutter's love and affection for young players, I think seems pretty likely. It's them and Coachella Valley for the Pacific Division title, and probably easily the Western Conference title. Like, this is a team that's going to have playoff expectations. And I think they can fulfill those.
I can't see anyone in the Central really challenging. Like, Texas is good, but like, I don't see them coming out on top if they have to face off against this team or Coachella Valley, honestly.
I don't know. I think I could see them squeaking by Texas, squeaking by Coachella Valley.
Yeah.
I think if Texas plays Calgary, that's going to be a mean series. Those are going to be two teams who, even though they don't play normally, they're not going to like each other by game three. And I think it's going to be a lot of very fun hockey, but like, I think it's going to be like a 2-1 triple OT kind of series between Matthew Murray, who rises to the occasion, and Dustin Wolf, who's already there. So I think that would be incredibly fun. Yeah. That would be a very good Western Conference final, and could be one. I assume that Texas is just going to walk through the Central in the playoffs unless some drastic changes happen at the trade deadline, which, you know, they might. So make sure you hit rewind and, you know, play this clip for me when I'm incredibly wrong in 2 months. All right, let's move on to the last team of the night. The one that's been in the news all week, because they got a big piece. Sarah, tee us up to talk about the Abbotsford Canucks.
All right, so the big news this week for the Canucks, like, franchise as a whole, is the Bo Horvat trade. Abbotsford is getting Atu Ratu from the Bridgeport Sound Tigers. They also lost Lane Peterson on a waiver claim by Columbus. So what is Abbotsford getting in Ratu, and can he fill the gap that's been left by Peterson?
Yeah, there have been a metric ton of articles and analysis of the trade, and who is Atu Ratu, what is Atu Ratu. Some have even asked, how is Atu Ratu? Perhaps we should be digging deeper and asking, why is Atu Ratu? When is Atu Ratu? Regardless, you're listening here, so let's start with what we think of Atu Ratu. And quite simply, he's a scoring forward. He has great puck skills, a lethal shot, big, strong, and while he doesn't throw his body around a lot, he's able to play through contact. He's able to use his size to win battles, to shield the puck, to get good position at the net front. He's a high motor player. He's an effective forechecker, and he's a lot better defensively than I think he gets credit for. He's been effective killing penalties for the Sound Tigers this season, which has been a breath of fresh air because they still insist on playing Jeff Kubiak on the other side of the penalty kill in Bridgeport. I don't know how you arrive at that decision year after year, but here we are. In short, he's got a lot of NHL skills and habits and is likely a useful middle six forward in the NHL, perhaps as soon as next season. Like, I think there is a world in which he makes the Vancouver Canucks out of camp as like their fourth line center that maybe gets some third line minutes here and there and then goes from there. I would hope that Vancouver has maybe learned its lesson with rushing players, though. And if he's not ready for that role, I see you shaking your head, Sarah.
it's the Canucks. I appreciate the optimism, but like,
I would like to think that they have turned corners, but seeing what they've done with Bruce Boudreau, anyway, but I think he is at least a player who is going to be someone Rick Tocchet likes. But however, like, everyone in the AHL, his game still has flaws. He still needs to work on some stuff. The biggest issue for him is definitely his skating. His stride is short. His ankle bend is very far from ideal. And this handicaps him being more effective on the rush, more effective in transition, and sometimes even more effective as a forechecker. Even though he's quite good at it, he would be a lot better if he could add a step to his skating. he's been able to offset some of those skating issues with a combination of improved playmaking, well-matched line mates, and a better kind of hockey IQ and awareness of the game around him. But at the NHL level, I think it's going to act as a ceiling for his potential. Rossi can overcome those speed issues and still be a top six center in the NHL, but he's going to need to gain more awareness and anticipation to do so. He's made strides in that so far, and he's young, but development isn't linear for anyone, nor is it a given. It absolutely is one of my biggest pet peeves when I hear hockey people, analysts, fans, whatever, who say, a player will only get better. Like, this guy will only get better. But no, that is not guaranteed. The AHL is littered with veterans who showed solid progress at 21, and by 25, were still the same guy. Like, development isn't linear, it's not guaranteed, and guys absolutely get worse. Like, that's a thing that does happen sometimes. I'm not saying that's the case here, but if Ratu wants to hit his ceiling as a top six center in the NHL, more work needs to be done and more development still needs to happen. He has plenty of runway to still make that happen, and I think his floor is pretty high in terms of becoming a useful everyday NHLer, but nothing's ever guaranteed with player developments. In terms of being a center versus a wing, if he can fix his skating stride to the point where he's in the ballpark of NHL average speed, yeah, he can definitely play center in the NHL. Second line, top six kind of mix. If he can't, but he can compensate for that with more development, his processing speed, anticipation, playmaking, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, I still think he can play center in a top six way in the NHL. You don't have to be a great skater to be an effective and high-level center in the NHL. Look at Leon Draisaitl, not a great skater. He's a wing, but Mark Stone could very much play center based on his level of anticipation. And his skating stride is uglier than mine. It's not faster, but it is uglier. If he can't compensate with more development in that area, he could still probably play center, just lower down in the lineup with the right line mates. As far as replacing production that Abbotsford lost with the Lane Peterson waiver claim, I'd say no for a few reasons. One, I think Peterson is probably a better player at the AHL level right now. He's above a point per game and has been around a point per game player in the AHL for some time now. So his production this year is not surprising. It's kind of, I would say, a breakout year for him. He's done a little bit better than what you would have expected given previous years, but he's always been a very good AHL player. Ratu isn't that yet, and I think it's unlikely he gets to that level this season. They also play very different games with very different skill sets. So even if they were equal in production, they aren't plug-and-play replacements for one another. Pettersson is better in transition. He's a better playmaker in the offensive zone. He's a more fluid skater, but doesn't use his skating that well. Whereas Ratu has better hands. He's better defensively. I think he's a better forechecker and is better able to battle through contact and doesn't kind of shy away from physicality. Like, Peterson isn't a shrinking flower in the corners, but like, he's not, you know, diving in, going for puck battles. Whereas Ratu's like, yeah, I can do that. Peterson is probably going to top out as a kind of good fourth liner who can chip in at the NHL level, which is more or less what he is right now. Ratu's ceiling is higher than that. Should Abby have been able to keep them both, we're talking about a team that could maybe be a dark horse to win the Western Conference, but they didn't. So we're here kind of thinking Abbotsford is a team that could maybe surprise people in the playoffs, but is very likely to finish kind of in that middle group somewhere between 3 and 6 in the Pacific Division. Sarah, any thoughts about Atu Ratu, the Abbotsford Canucks, Lane Peterson, or Jeff Kubiak killing penalties?
I mean, first of all, why? No, I mean, the Peterson claim, like, it didn't surprise me because literally everyone on Columbus is dead and they need, like, people to play there. But, you know, I feel like we had just talked about them previously on the show and, you know, I'd been looking at him and being like, man, sure wish he'd shown any signs of being this player for the, like, 4 games he played in Chicago. And, you know, he was really instrumental, I think, in helping make Abbotsford be better than I think we had thought that they were going to be. And so I feel like that's a big loss for them. Yeah, they're you can't just one for one swap these guys and be like, ah, you will now fill this role, Atu Ratu. But, you know, good luck in Columbus. I guess he'll get to play NHL minutes because who else is?
Yeah, I mean, Columbus is... Well, I mean, Columbus should be absolutely, blowing it for Bedard right now. Yeah. But then again, so should a lot of teams. Sorry, never mind. Gary Bettman says that doesn't happen.
No,
so
that's not. No.
I'm sorry, Gary, that I suggested that. All right, Sarah, any closing thoughts before we go to start bench ship?
Let's just do it. Let's do it.
All right. We have start bench ship to play. If you are new to this segment of the show, start bench ship is the same general concept as a game I'm sure you're familiar with. We'll call it friend, marry, kill. Same general guidelines. If you're not familiar with that, I think if you just watch us play, you'll probably get the hang of it. This is, you know, given that this is All-Star Weekend, we're going to play an All-Star Weekend themed start bench ship here. So let's start it off with All-Star Skills Competition events. There is the hardest shot, the fastest skater, and the accuracy shooting. Because I don't even know what the other events might be. The puck relay, some goalie thing, a breakaway. Yeah, let's stick with the big three here. Sarah, start bench ship. What do you got?
All right. So I am starting the accuracy shooting because it either goes very well or very horribly. And either way is entertaining. Because either you get the guy who just like kills it and hits all four of them immediately, or you get someone who's stuck up there for like a minute. And then you're like, oh, this is like secondhand embarrassment. This is bad. Benching fastest skater. You skated in a circle real fast. I don't know. Like, that's impressive, but whatever. I am shipping hardest shot solely because they did not bring Martin Furk back to redo it this year. Like, if he was coming back, it'd be an immediate start. But like, we're shipping it because they decided not to give him the chance to reclaim or redo, re-engage, whatever. He doesn't get to do it again, and that makes me annoyed.
I don't know if you saw my theory that I put out there on Twitter about my first hard shot.
Yes. It's a brave theory.
I think there's a chance. Because, like, if that's what happens, everything makes sense. This was, like, secret specialist at the NHL All-Star Game, Martin Furk, and that's why he's not at the AHL All-Star Game. If that's not the case, then this is entirely too dumb.
Right.
But I'm going to start in reverse order here. I am shipping fastest skater. That event peaked when Kendall Coyne Schofield did the demonstration lap. That was an iconic moment, and that's it. That event has peaked. I am benching the hardest shot because while it is a fun event, it feels like everyone just watched the dude, you know, clap the puck, and then we all just turned to the like speedometer thing. Like the hardest shooting is my start here, or the accuracy shooting is my start here, because there is something appealing about watching the targets just get blown up. Like they need to come up with a way to make hardest shot like that in some way, like some kind of thing gets damaged. Like instead of shooting the shot at the net, they shoot it at like a used car, like Street Fighter style, or something like that. Like, or it goes through like a pane of glass that's painted like a brick wall. Like there needs to be some kind of like extra element that everyone like, oh, that looked fast.
Ooh, yeah.
No, that was only 98. Like there needs to be some kind of effects, whereas like the accuracy shooting, watching those targets just get absolutely obliterated, there's some like primal joy that is just not replicated by other events. All right, let's go on here and let's go to All-Star jerseys. We have the 1997, 2016, and 2019 All-Star jerseys from the AHL. I will kick us off here. I am shipping the 2019 AHL jersey. It is a jersey. Like it basically is a very bare minimum. Like it says AHL across the front, has a couple stars. Each division got at least like some more poppy kind of colors. Like this was the Pacific Division's gold jersey, so that kind of popped a little bit, but they are very, like, you could have told me that was from any All-Star game between now and 2002 probably, and I'd be like, okay, like what host city is that from? I have no idea. Like there is nothing about capturing the spirit of Springfield in that jersey. I am benching the 1997 version. It is a very 90s All-Star jersey with like the star and the AHL's like a guy catching a pass silhouette just like boom right on the hip. With the like wavy kind of like It's goofy looking, but at least you tried something a little different. I'm 100% starting the 2016 one. That is a retro look, and I'm here for it. Like, that is a very cool vintage vibe to it and stands out from other all-star jerseys that the AHL has done from the past by a pretty wide margin for me. Sarah, what say you?
We're just going to copy paste everything you just said and repeat it because you're 100% right. No notes. Like, that is exactly what I was going with. I love that retro 2016 jersey. Yeah, the 97 one is very 1997. The, like, gradient on the colors. 2019 feels like something that if you had asked me to design a jersey that I would have done because I can't design anything. Like, that I would have been like, well, I can make text and that's it. So yeah, no, that's you are completely correct with these ones.
Yeah. Like the 2019 one looks like an all-star jersey for like high school.
Right.
Like that very easily, if that would have said AHL instead of AHL, it would have said like, CPIHL, Central Pennsylvania Interscholastic Hockey League.
Yeah.
Totally would have bought that.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, not purchased it. I would have accepted that was true.
Yeah.
Like it's just not, it's not great. No. All right. Moving on to our last start bench ship for the evening here. We have all-star formats. There is the current four division where the North, Atlantic, Central, and Pacific all have the 3-on-3 tournament. There's what most all-star games are across sport, which is one conference versus the other, in this case, East versus West. And then there was the wild thing they did for a little bit with not USA versus Canada, Planet USA versus Canada. Why was it Planet USA? Sarah, kick us off. How do you think of these all-star formats?
This is rough. All right. We're going to start the four divisions largely because, like, everyone knows that the game portion of the all-star game is the least, like, exciting part. And at least with, like, the four distinct teams, it makes the games be much shorter. Like, it's like a 15-minute game or whatever. So you get that part, like, out of the way. Just, it's done. We're going to bench East versus West because, like, that makes it, like, it's a whole hockey game. Like, we don't need that. And it's so much. We're shipping this Planet USA versus Canada thing because honestly, like, we don't need Canada to be any more full of themselves than they already are about hockey. And like, everyone versus Canada, like, they're going to win. And then we're going to have to hear about it. So like, cool idea, but I want something different.
All right, I'm going to agree with you, but for very different reasons. Yeah. I like the four divisions because I feel like that 3-on-3 tournament is getting closer to the NHL accepting what the all-star game format should be, and that's what NHL 3s was in the EA Sports NHL series, where it's basically a 3-on-3 mini, like the rink is like half the size, there are no blue lines, and they do like what they call the money puck, where they pull random, like every face off, you have a random puck that could either be just a normal puck, or if you score, it's worth two goals, or if you score, it counts one for you and takes three goals off the other team. Like, it's basically just a Charlie Day wild card bitches kind of element to the game. The four divisions is coming closer to that, but that's ultimately what the NHL should do. They should just copy EA Sports NHL 3s, and that's the all-star format. Outdoors. East versus West, we're going to bench. I at least felt like this is what everyone basically does across sports. You know, the Pro Bowl, the MLB All-Star Game, the NBA, they do East West. It works. It's fine. I have no idea what the, because like the NHL did like North America versus the world, and then like AHL tried to do some kind of thing for that because the players going to the Olympics, and it's such a goofy concept of the U.S. All-Star, the teams in the U.S. have one All-Star team and the teams in Canada have another All-Star team. It's just like, that's a stupid format for this thing. Not to mention the Planet USA. Like, do Americans not already have a big enough deal about themselves that we need to claim that they have the planet?
Legit.
I don't understand what the logic behind that was. If it was corporate sponsorship, then just why?
It's weird.
It's very strange. Like, it very much feels like a minor league thing. Like, that's something, yes, I would expect out of like the ECHL. So yeah, shame on you, AHL, for propping that format up for like a lot longer than people remember. So, all right. That is Start Bench Ship. Sarah, any closing thoughts here on the show?
I'm going to be consumed by thinking about that Planet USA thing for like hours. It's so weird.
I'm just thankful that for once we were not scooped and we didn't find out that Troy Mann got fired until, yes, tomorrow morning. I did this whole thing, like, because you know, if you wouldn't have said that,
oh,
at,
yeah,
the end of that, at the end of your answer there, I'd have been like, do you think that Troy Mann is feeling the heat on his seat right now?
Like, or I don't know. Maybe
have him already have been fired, yeah, on the show. Oh. Anyway.
Sports, man.
All right. I think we've been here long enough. Sarah, take us out.
That is it for the show today. Thank you so much for watching and or listening. The Calder Farmstead is a part of the Full Press Radio Network. You can find this and several other great hockey, sports, and sports entertainment programs all at www.fullpresscoverage.com. Just click the podcast drop-down menu in the top right portion of the website and enjoy.
And if you are enjoying the show, please make sure you subscribe so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon, please rate and review the podcast. Or if you're watching on YouTube, like the video and comment what you thought of the episode. Doing so helps others find the show, and your reviews help us improve it. You could also follow the show on social media at Calder Farmstead on Twitter, at The Calder Farmstead on Instagram and Facebook. Links to all of that and more can be found on our Linktree page, which is linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. Big thanks to Adrian Drake, who made our theme music. You can find him on social media at AD_dysfunction. That's AD_DYSFUNCTION. So we can make music for you too. Sarah, where can people find you?
As always, my name is Sarah Avampato. You can find me representing Full Press Hockey on Twitter at Right Said Sarah. It's WRITE Said Sarah with an H. You can check out my writing at Full Press Hockey, where I talk about the Ontario Reign, or over at Kane's Country, where I talk about the Chicago Wolves. Sean, where can folks find you?
I'm Sean O'Brien. You can find me on Twitter at SeanO'Brien81. That's SeanOBrien81. I'm also on Instagram at SeanO'Brien_81. You can find my stats work on Tableau at bit.ly/data-dump-and-chase. All lowercase, all one word. Thank you for tuning into the show. For the great Sarah Avampato, I am Sean O'Brien. And as always, please dump and chase responsibly.